We'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to the podcast. Please don't argue with facts. This is your host, Chadwick. We have Corey here as well.
I am.
We have a special guest here, Ray Andriacchio. Ray, thank you for being here today.
Thank you all for asking me.
Yeah, we know that you have been at the center in your son's case. Christian has been at the center of a lot of controversy this summer, this past few years. And how has life, I want to start off by asking you, since the Couple of Podcast has been released, how has life been for you, Ray, and for your family dealing with this emotionally, mentally? How has life been for you since then?
I think that after the podcast or during the podcast, it's been a lot of ups and downs, kind of roller coaster, because there's been good days where you felt like, I'm glad I did this. I'm glad I feel like this is moving the case forward, is making people aware of Christian's life and his death and the events surrounding it. Then there were the bad days when things happened that was probably prompted by the podcast and the publicity that it got. People becoming angry about that from the other side, as we, I guess you could say, the people who were suspects or who were suspects for us. And, obviously the release of the autopsy photos was a huge blow to us as a family. Again, it was a lot of kind of ups and downs, and we've been very grateful for the support that we've received and the outpouring from all over the country, but especially locally and in the state of Mississippi. But we've, also been very shocked at the viciousness of the attacks, social media-wise, from, people who would argue that it's a suicide or who have a personal stake in the case, whether that's their family of people who are people of interest or whether politically they had something to lose if this case moved forward.
Well, something I was talking to Chad earlier, I was like, after looking over everything and seeing all the different takes on people's takes and the podcast and all that, it's one thing dynamic I didn't see was the dynamic and how it all came together, in a sense of how, your son met the girlfriend and how the other people involved, how they played a role in his life before the incident. So initially, did the guys involved, were they friends of him before the girlfriend or after the girlfriend?
Dylan, who was the other person at the apartment, he had gone to school with Christian at Northeast for, Christian started at Northeast in ninth grade. So, I don't know exactly at what point Dylan was in and out of school. I think he missed a year of school, someone said. Don't know that for sure, but, there were some school absences. He and Christian were not, I wouldn't say they were best friends by any means. They were acquaintances. They mm-hmm. may see each other somewhere. And, of course, they didn't have any animosity against mm-hmm. each other. I don't think that they hung out, per se. Christian had his group of friends that he kind of hung out with that, quite frankly, some of them were older than him. And they were at Northeast, but they might have been a grade or two ahead of him. And his best friend, Taylor Dial, he was a year, I think, ahead of him in school. And Dylan just was not a part of their group that they would go out and, go hunting or go, boating. We lived at the lake, and so they would go out on the lake. Dylan kind of entered the picture more so when Christian broke up. He and his girlfriend, his long-term girlfriend, broke up. They had been in a relationship for 5 years, really the only girlfriend Christian had really ever had. And I just think it was kind of, I won't say fate, but just kind of one of those situations, a happen chance that they ran into each other. Dylan had just broke up with his girlfriend, I think.
So they both had something to
right. They kind of were both at loose ends. And so let's go hang out together. Let's go to this party together. Let's go whatever. And Dylan lived at Delwood, so they were in close proximity. They knew a lot of the same people. So it was pretty soon, pretty quickly, like within 2 or 3 weeks, that they were at a party and Christian met Whitley. And so, I think it started out just like most relationships start out as kind of casual. and, you know, hey, you know, whatever, we hook up and then we're going to hang out, we're going to talk or whatever. And then it, you know, of course, progressed to where they were actually boyfriend, girlfriend. It just so happens that Whitley and Dylan lived across the road from each other, and they had known each other, you know, for years. And so they were better friends, I guess you'd say, than Christian and Dylan. And so Dylan was always there. You know, he was always with the, he was there a lot with the two of them. It was kind of a, you know, the three of them. And then with Christian's work schedule, he was gone for 30 days and he was only home for 15. Okay. So you're talking about a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you say, well, they were there together for 8 months. Well, really, how much of that time? I mean, he was gone a month at a time and only home 15. So you're talking about really not together one-on-one that much. But when he was home, they were the three of them together a lot. Now, I would describe their relationship as leeches. You know, they leached the blood out of Christian money-wise. And that was one of, I guess, the conflicts between me and Christian was that I, as his mother, wanted to protect him and say, these people are using you.
Was Christian a very trusting guy? Was he, you think he was very trusting of people?
He was. Not necessarily, I won't say he wasn't naive, but he was one of those type of people of, until you do something to me, I'm not going to hold anything against you. You know.
Start you off with an A+.
Right. And you know, yeah, we're going to start off on an even playing field. Yeah. Now, if you go against me or, you know, if you hurt me in some way, but my husband has always put it to me very well, and it may not sound good, but he's always said, you know, Ray, we taught Christian how to treat people right. We never taught him how to treat people wrong. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, Christian's friends, I mean, he just wasn't around people who took advantage of him. I mean, the girlfriend who we still refer to her as his girlfriend, she was a very good girl, you know. She didn't go out and party. She was a straight-A student. She's actually graduated veterinarian school now, and she's, you know, leading a wonderful life, and we're so happy for her. And, you know, her family was a very good family, and they took Christian. I mean, they were like his second parents. And he just wasn't surrounded by people who, like, took advantage of him or who, you know, he just wasn't used to that, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And his peer group or his friends that he socialized with were all pretty good guys. I mean, you know, they were all working. They all were self-sufficient. And then enters Whitley and Dylan. And Dylan, you know, couldn't keep a job. You know, some would say had a drug problem. Well, many would say he had a drug problem. He and Whitley, you know, liked to do drugs together. So they were always looking for money. And Christian was very free. He was very open, good-hearted when it came to, he wasn't someone that was like, well, this is my money and I'm not giving you any. You know, if he went out to eat, he was going to pay for everybody. If he went, you know, and so they took advantage of that.
What kind of relationship did you and Christian have as mother, son? Mm-hmm. Was it one that you guys could communicate pretty openly and freely about things? Or do you think maybe there's some things he could have talked to you more about? How was that dynamic between you two?
We always had a really good relationship up until Whitley. And then our relationship, you know, I've been very open about talking about that. Well, our relationship was very strained when he passed away, because of Whitley. She and I had a very poor relationship, and she tried to alienate Christian and I. You know, after we got his phone and we saw some of the text messages on the phone where, you know, like she would intercept messages and we would be, Christian, for example, Christian and I had this kind of routine that he and I would always go out to eat the day before he went back to the boat because he was going to be gone for a month. You know, it's kind of like, okay, you've been home for 2 weeks before you get back on the boat. Let's, you know, we're going, you know, it was just kind of our way of touching base. And of course he lived with us, up until, November. He had moved out, then he passed away in February. But he had always lived with us, and so, of course, I saw him. But that was just kind of our one-on-one time of let's talk.
Let's have a conversation.
Yeah, yeah, you know. Right, you know. And that was just something that we had done ever since he had gone to work on the boat. And then Whitley enters the picture. And so, you know, Christian, okay, we're going to go eat before you leave. No answer. Okay, so now my feelings are hurt because this is our thing and you're not responding to me. Well, then, you know, maybe later that night he texts me and says, I thought we was going to go eat. Why didn't you text me? Well, I did. No, you didn't. And so it was this thing. Then later we found out that there were times when she would have his phone. And so she would, you know, he would never receive the message. So we were, there were that kind of things going on that now looking back, you know, my advice to any parent is don't depend on text. Pick up the phone and call, you know, hear your voice. You know I do that a lot more now with my children. I just want to hear it from you on the phone. Know that you got it. Know what tone of voice you're saying this message in. Not, you know, me reading this right. And in my mind it's being sent in a different tone.
Yeah, you have
I was telling him something about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like sometimes the nuance of what you're saying don't carry that. Like they don't carry across it. Like somebody posts on Facebook, you might mean it in this way, but like your tone is not set by, you know, you have to kind of like, it's better to say things and just type it up.
Right. Well, I was watching a comedian, this has been months ago, but it was a very good, and when I heard it, I was like, exactly, that's exactly like what I was trying to say about some of these messages on the phone. Because, you know, he said, like, with the Me Too movement, you know, you can have, he said, if somebody makes some allegations against you, if you have somebody in the courtroom that's reading these messages and you have a bad read and it says, I said, no, stop, whatever. He said, but in real life, it might've been, no,
right.
Stop. Oh, you know, and they said, it totally puts it into a whole different perspective. And so I was like, exactly, you know, some of these messages that people have made such, I mean, can I sit here and say that he meant them in a different way, a different tone? I don't know. Yeah, but also, you don't know, person that. So there's a lot of things that I say, I don't know, but you also don't know. So we basically can't count that as evidence, I guess you'd say, because we can't prove one way or the other.
And I want to ask you, Ray, is that a big part of, does that cause you problems, the fact that you don't know for 100%? What may have happened or transpired. Like you just said, I don't know for a fact that this happened, you know. Does that bother you in it that you don't know for 100% that something may or may not have happened?
No, I know for 100% that they killed him.
Okay.
What I don't know is, what bothers me is not knowing exactly what happened. What were these people thinking when they did that? Was it planned? Was it just, you know, they asked him for some money and he said no, and then they thought they was going to bulldog him and he fought and so they killed him? Was it an accident? Was, you know, did they lure him home intentionally knowing they was going to kill him when he got here? Did he hurt? Did he die immediately? You know, I've been sent text, you know, I've been sent texts, or not texts, but things have been posted on Reddit where somebody said, you know, I'll pay, they, you know, of course saying they were Whitley. I don't know if it was Whitley or not. It could very well have been because she's an evil person. But said, you know, if Ray will pay me, I don't remember what the amount was, $15,000 or $150,000 or something, I'll tell her what the last moments of Christian was like, and with him sitting there begging me to help him. You know, well, what mother wants to, you know, and you know, and they said the noises that he was making and the gurgling. I mean, who wants to? But, you know, I guess that's what bothers me is, like, you know, did he struggle to breathe?
Yeah.
Did he? We know that he was shot pretty soon when on arriving at the apartment because of the level of rigor. Well, I mean, they didn't call 911 until 4:45. And Dylan went to Chick-fil-A and bought food. So they come back and eat while he laid in the bathtub upstairs, you know. And did he die immediately, or was he struggling? Yeah.
Okay. You say you went to Chick-fil-A and bought food. Mm-hmm. How did he pay for it?
It's Christian's car.
So he used Christian's car to pay mm-hmm. for food when he was upstairs dead.
Well, they say that he was shot at 3:30. That's what's in the police report. But the level of rigor, the forensic science says, which there's no arguing with science, science says that it had to have been noon. You know, had to be assumed pretty much when he arrived there.
We're going to go with science. 12 o'clock noon. Mm-hmm. When he goes to get food, this is, what time did they say this happened?
Well, he first goes to the bank and tries to withdraw off Christian's money.
At what time was this?
That was at, now I may be wrong by a minute or so, but let's just say, I want to say it was at 12:41. But, and then he goes from there to Chick-fil-A.
So, science says 12 o'clock. 12:40, mm-hmm. he's at this guy's with mm-hmm. his car at a bank getting food.
That we have on video.
At a bank getting money, trying to get money and trying to get food. Gets food, goes back to the house, correct? Mm-hmm. With the food, mm-hmm. while using his card, he's already, like normally if I bought food, if I sent somebody to the store and buy mm-hmm. food with my card, I'm normally getting stuff from me too. So they didn't go and say, hey, let's go up here and see if he wants to eat now at 1:30 when he gets back or 1 o'clock. They don't go and see if he's upstairs.
Well, according to their story, you know, he, of course, was alive and well. And, science says, and then we have a person, actually, when the podcast came out, someone who was living at the apartment, who now, she was a military wife, and so now, of course, they're gone. I mean, we've never met this person, never had any contact with her, and she posted, well, I was living there and I heard the gunshot and I even reported it to the office manager the next day. And, you know, she estimates that the time that she heard it was at 12:30. And the reason why she remembers that is because her child, she had him on a schedule of when she would put him down to sleep. And she said that she would put him down to sleep from 11 to 2. And that she knows that he was asleep and had been asleep for, and she said that the gunshot was so loud or so pronounced, you know, it was obviously a gunshot, that she ran and got him out of bed and they went and got in a closet because she said it sounded like it was right outside their door. And she said, you know, I thought maybe people were out shooting and he slept under a window. And so she was afraid it would come through the window and whatever. So that was information that we didn't have, but it backed up then what the forensic pathologist. So it was like everything was kind of backing up each other. And without one person knowing the other person's, you know, statement or valid, you know, whatever. So something else that came out from the podcast was then the one of the first responders, one of the EMTs, you know, contacted us and said, well, you know, I was kind of surprised that nobody ever talked to me. And we was like, well, we didn't, you know about you. And he said that, that, you know, he described very detailed about how the state, the scene and the state of rigor, you know, that Christian was in, which again, backed up Arden, our forensic pathologist, and that the time of death was way wrong. From what they said. But, you know, my thing has always been, so let's just say that they're telling the truth, which we know they're not, but let's play devil's advocate and say they're telling the truth and it was 3:30. You still didn't make a phone call, 911 phone call to 4:45. So what person waits an hour and 15 minutes to make a 911 call?
Yeah. Do you think someone dropped the ball during an investigation of this case and maybe the scene where everything took place, do you think there could have been a better investigation of all of that?
Oh, there's no doubt it could have been a better investigation. The problem is it should have just been an investigation. There was no investigation. Right. They collected no evidence except taking the gun. They took a statement from Dylan and Whitley, but even though there were so many questions, they didn't ask them. you know, we feel it was a cover-up, that basically they were told, do not, you know, this is a suicide, this is what, it supposedly, you know, the investigators, well, that's not, I mean, they have made this statement, but the investigators there say that the chief at the time was Chief Lee, that he came in and he said, it's stop investigating, shut it down, it's a suicide.
Now, you said at 12:41, Dylan went to the bank to get money out of, why did he go to the bank to get money out of his account? Like, what?
He says that Christian told him to go get all of his money out of the bank, but Christian didn't give him his PIN number. He didn't call the bank and say, hey, my buddy's coming down there. You know, the people at the bank had like a two-step identification process. They would have had to have had hit not just his PIN number, but they would have had to have had a code that only, you know, like Christian knew. It wasn't like a PIN code, it was like actually a word. And he didn't have any of that. So and Christian would have known that. They knew that Christian called down there and checked his balance a lot and that kind of thing, and so that story really doesn't fly. The other thing is if Christian was alive, why didn't you just pick up the phone and call him and say, hey, man, you need to call them and tell them that, you know, I can have your money.
Yeah.
But he didn't do that.
So how did this gain national recognition, right? You know, the couple of podcasts, of course. I remember seeing, was it True Crimes or something?
Crime Watch.
Crime Watch. I saw that on TV a while back. How did this case began to pick up national recognition?
Well, in 2017, Kate Royals, who was a journalist, I guess you'd say, at Mississippi Today, which is an online magazine or publication, she actually was friends. She knew our attorney and in Jackson, and our attorney said, you know, you might want to look at this and do a story on it. You know, it's kind of interesting. It's got a lot of, you know, kind of things that would catch people's attention. So she did a story, and it kind of hit a nerve. And then, and of course, it had all local people talking, but that was pretty much it. It was just pretty much local. And then Crime Watch Daily contacted us, and they had seen, I guess they have people who that's all they do is look for stories, and they contacted us and said, we'd like to do a story. So then they came and did that, of course, and that got more national attention. And we really thought that that was going to put pressure on the police department and Bilbo, who was the DA at the time, to, you know, do the right thing. And it did put some pressure on them. They did do a little bit, but not really. It was almost just like to pacify us. And then it kind of died down. And everybody kind of thought that it had gone away, but we had just kind of been working this whole time on continuing to try and investigate ourselves, since nobody else would do it. And we had hired our own experts. We had, you know, I was stalking people on Facebook and, you know, watching people's profiles and the things they said and kind of keeping up with who was dating who in that group of people. And then I don't know how I thought. I mean, I heard about a podcast. I'd never listened to a podcast. I can't remember. It seems like maybe I listened to Serial. I don't know if y'all listened to Serial. And after listening to that, I thought, well, you know, that is a way of getting the story out there. And I'll just do my own podcast. You know, nobody will listen to it, but locally, but because it's about somebody they know locally, and that's really the people I wanted, was the local people. So I sent my niece to Nashville. There was a what they call CrimeCon. It's where all your true crime shows and podcasts go to, and she went there, and they had what they call Podcast Row, and it's where all the podcasts are, and they'll give you their information. Well, there was this company called Resonate Recordings who she had stopped and talked to, and they actually did the editing for a podcast. So when I was telling her about, I thought I was just going to try and do my own podcast. I asked, you know, I was saying I've got to find somebody though that can help me or can edit it or something, because don't know anything about all that stuff. And she says, well, I have a card. And so she gave me the card. I called them to say, this is what I want to do. You know, how much is it going to cost me for you to edit and put music to it and all the stuff, you know, that kind of goes along with podcasts. And they said, well, I mean, what's your podcast going to be about? And I got to telling them. And after an hour of talking to him on the phone, wow, he said, I tell you what, let's just take a break here. And we've been looking for a story to do our own podcast, because at this point they had never done a podcast. And he said, let me talk to my boss and let's kind of reconvene tomorrow. And so we did that and had another about an hour and a half phone conversation. And at the end of it, they said, you know, we want to do this for you. You know, we want to tell your story, but we want to be the ones to do it. And of course, I was more than happy to relinquish it because I didn't really know what I was doing. And nobody wants to listen to my voice, you know, the Southern voice. So, and that's just, it was really just chance. It was really fate. They're very good guys, very ethical, very respectful.
Did you have any idea that it was going to take off the way it has, though? This case is, it's big locally, but like I said, it even gone a lot of national attention now. Did you have any idea that it would get to this level of notoriety?
I mean, of course we hoped. I mean, we knew that they had a lot of connections, you know, whereas I had none. They had a lot of connections with, like, a lot of the big podcasts, like Tenderfoot, Up and Vanish. They did the editing for them. So they were able to partner with people that we would never have been able to partner with or even known to partner with. And so we knew that they were going to have a pretty large audience, but we didn't. What I didn't expect was Christian's story to touch people like it has, and, you know, and to draw people in the way it has. And I think that just speaks to Christian. I mean, he was just that.
Did you find any solace or peace knowing that this story in some kind of way helped other people find peace or come to grips with their losses as well? Do you find any kind of peace of mind from that part of it?
I won't say peace of mind. I find that it helps in knowing that maybe, I know it's a cliche to say, well, he didn't die in vain. You know, whoever, you know, you hear people say that, well, at least I didn't die in vain. And I feel like that's how it is more that at least his death meant something. You know, and it is help, you know, he continues to help people. You know, just like he tended, I mean, that's how he ended up in this very chaotic and terrible relationship with Whitley. Is he, at the end of the day, he just wanted to help her, you know, and she was playing the victim. Here's this girl who, you know, she's telling him that she's got a poor home life and nobody will take care of her and she just needs somebody to love her. And you know, when he came kind of in and wanted to be the white knight. But yes, I mean, I think just knowing that there's people who've contacted me and said, you know, my brother, my husband, my whoever, you know, my family member, they said that he committed suicide, and I never did think that he did it, but I didn't know what to do. And now, you know, you've motivated me to call and get those police records and to ask questions, and you've kind of given me a direction of how to go and do this process. And, you know, or even people who say, you know, I don't have the money to hire an investigator or to do whatever, but just, it's almost like they feel like my fight is kind of helping them deal with their fight, mm-hmm. you know, or their lack of fight, you know, because they didn't have the resources to fight or the know-how. It's almost like, I mean, I've had them literally say, I can't do anything for my family member, but I'm glad that you're doing this because I feel like you're helping me just by you continuing to fight.
So, let's say, after everything said and done, what is one thing you want to see come from this situation, besides justice mm-hmm. in your eye, but something else that might be to the advantage of somebody else who might similarly go through the same thing, or something else might happen where something seems covered up to a point where they can't do it. What is something you think you could change to make the situation better?
I think there are two things that I would like. I mean, with justice aside, you know, Christian people being arrested mm-hmm. and everything aside, the other two things that I guess byproducts that I would like to come out of this would be, one, and we've already started the process with this, is we want to get legislation passed that says that autopsy photos cannot be released to anyone except law enforcement without the family's consent.
Because yours were released without your consent.
Right. And I feel like that there is no useful purpose for anyone's autopsy photos to ever be given out to anyone other than family. And I really don't even know why family would want them, but if they did, you know, so I mean, to protect, to know that Christian could protect another family, another victim, another, you know, somebody going through what we've gone through, and to have, you know, Christian's law out there and his namesake, that he continues to protect victims from going through this. So we're starting that. We have senator who's going to sponsor the bill. We know it's a long fight because they say that like 95% of bills are killed in committee and never get passed. But I just feel like who could not want to sponsor? I mean, what decent person?
That seems like a harmless way.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a, to me, a no-brainer. And you know, in this whole process, I've always tried to, I guess you'd say, be one step ahead of people, the other side, by always kind of thinking, okay, what could they do? Like, if I say this, what is going to be their response? And then I would have a plan B, A and B, of what my response then would be to their response. And in all of my scenarios and problem solving, it never in my mind ever did I ever say, oh, I'm worried that they're going to release autopsy photos, and so when they do that, this is what I'm going to do. Because, I mean, to me, common human decency, you just wouldn't do that. But that would be one thing. The other thing would be that, and I think that we already see this happening, and I credit Christian's story for this, is that locally and even in other communities, that people now are becoming more aware of the power of the district attorney and how important a position that is, and how you need to have an ethical and good person, compassionate person, because that person is the ultimate advocate for a victim. And, you know, I think we look at them as the person who's putting away the bad guys, you know, or whatever. But on the flip side of that, they are supposed to be taking care of the victim. And
you feel like that wasn't the case for you?
Oh, that's not, no. This is just the opposite. They have worked against us, and they have re-victimized us. And the district attorney is 100% responsible for that. And, you know, just... Anyway, we won't even get into that.
that's one thing I take from when I see somebody go through something and you want to, you know, show some type of sympathy and, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, I know, like I said, you got people that believe that it was a suicide. Mm-hmm. You got people that don't believe it was a suicide. And the one thing I see in between those two things is, you still should want due process if you believe this or you don't believe this. You still should want to see everything be exhausted to understand if this is really what it is. Because at the end of the day, that could be your family member, that could be your sister, your brother, your uncle, your whatever. And you want to see everything be extended to, you know, to its full extent to make sure it is exactly what it is. And with your story, I see the difference in if it was Joe Blow from down the street, like somebody just, and then like, but it seems like with your son, like it seems like a cover up from the evidence, like the scientific thing that I'm saying, he died at 3 something, and the scientific proven things that he died at noon. That alone, right, that gives me, you know, doubt in the whole situation. So to just shut it down automatically is
well, and that's always been our argument to the different, you know, we've been through 2 different police chiefs, we've been through about 3 different sets of Meridian police investigators, we've been through the attorney general's office, an NBI investigator, and you know, people will say, well, I mean, it's been investigated by 3 different agencies and they all have come to the same conclusion. And my response is, it has yet to be investigated. It has been, you know, when you have witnesses that have never been talked to, that say, I have information. I mean, there was someone on Christian's boat who had a conversation with the DA's son who was working on the boat, and the DA's son told him, this person called me and told me he shot Christian, the DA's son. But yet you never talk to him, and you never question him, and the DA never tells anybody about it. Or if he did, he told them, we're not going to talk about this. When you have statements sent to the Attorney General's office from people saying, I have information, but they never contact them, they never talk to them, they will not talk to us, they refuse to talk to us. You know, it's when you totally, again, if you have nothing to hide, then why aren't you saying, okay, you want that DNA tested? Let's test it. I mean, you know, if he'll shut you up, yeah, let's test it. You know, if you want a ballistics report on that gun, because we should have done one, because it, you know, but we didn't, let's do it. And, you know, but you refuse to do any of that.
So, okay, now let me, I want to say, what reason for covering it up? Is it because they didn't do the job from the beginning and they just saying, okay, to avoid getting into any more cover, just going to continue to cover it up? Or is it somebody trying to cover somebody else? What reason would they have to make this a suicide instead of going at it as a murder, homicide, as it should be? Or, you know.
Well, I think the people involved, there were, you know, discounting Dylan and Whitley, the other people involved are, yes, I mean, our what we have evidence, I guess you'd say, or statements that prove that, you know, the DA son, I'm not saying that he was there or that he was involved, other than he had information.
Accessory after.
Well, I mean, and I'm not even, you know, going to say that, even though I guess it would fall under that. It's more the thing that he had information and, you know, and now he's deceased. Mm-hmm. And so we can't go and, you know, he can't be questioned. I think that, you know, the person that we have a witness seeing coming out of the apartment who's never been in a police report or never been questioned was the DA's son's best friend.
Somebody else mm-hmm. was at the apartment at mm-hmm. the time.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all of this could have been wrapped up probably in the first 48 hours if they had done their job and if they had actually questioned people and followed the inconsistencies. And, you know, there's things that even I, not being an investigator, you know, was sitting here kind of screaming when you got the case file from the Meridian Police Department and you saw the questions that they asked. It was like, but why didn't you ask this? You know, if they said, well, the night before we went shooting guns and it was me, you know, Whitley and my cousin and a friend, what would be one of your questions you would ask? Who was the friend?
Yeah.
That question was never asked. That's what's in the thing. It was me and Dill, you know, but no questions asked, like, okay, but what's the name of the friend?
Yeah.
I mean, it took us a year to find out the friend.
Yeah.
And it was like, why was that not? I mean, you know, you're supposed to be a trained investigator, and I'm someone who's never been into true crime or never even thought about questioning somebody, but yet that's my first thing. Of why didn't you take it another step and say, well, who was the friend?
Now, let me ask you real quick, Ray, because this has been a firestorm on social media. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen arguments pro and against. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask you, what would you say to those that says, oh, this really is a suicide, and maybe Ray and her grief doesn't want to see that it was a suicide, or maybe she just don't want to believe that Christian may have harmed himself? What do you say to that audience that still believes that part of it?
Well, my response would be, you know, that I can understand people saying that. And quite frankly, until we had the experts come in, I didn't really have any, you know, I couldn't prove anything. All I could say is what I thought or my gut feeling or, you know, well, this didn't seem right. But then when we hire the experts and the forensic evidence, I mean, it's there and there's no manipulating it. You know, you can't say the evidence is lying. You can't say that somebody's, you know, we've been accused of paying people. We've been accused of all these different things. But at the end of the day, we have more forensic evidence. Just take that. Don't even take people's statements and everything else. But we have more forensic evidence than most cases that people are indicted and go to prison on. And I mean, we've had attorneys tell us this. We've had all kind of people who are in law enforcement say, we don't even understand why this is where it is, even just based on what you have. So if they could, and I've told the police this several years ago, I told DeBos, I said, okay, well, you sit down with me and you explain to me, you know, why, how rigor set in an hour to the degree it was, you know, how, you know, why there was gunshot residue on Dylan's hand when Dylan's saying he wasn't even there. That's not possible. You know, just all the different things that we had, you explain that to me to where, you know, it's logical and scientific, and then I might agree with you, but nobody has been able to, they avoid that. They go to, well, but, you know, there's some things that just can't be explained.
Was there gun residue on Christian's hand?
Yes. Gunshot residue on all three.
All three of them.
Right, which, you know, of course, the forensic pathologist says, well, of course there'd be gunshot residue on his hands because he was there. I mean, you know, there's going to be gunshot residue on him.
Another thing is, saying if it was a suicide and he died at 3 o'clock, is what they're saying, right? What led up to him getting home from off the, you know, coming home from work? Did him and her have an argument? Or there's an argument between all three of them and he just got pissed off and went, like, what?
Wait, why did he go?
Why would he
get off the boat?
Get off the boat, go home, and kill himself when he get home? Was there something when he got home that he didn't like, didn't see? Like, what caused him, if that's motive to killing himself? Like, I know some people say some people are depressed, but does he have history of depression or anything like that
No, he didn't have a history of depression. Everybody would tell you that he never appeared depressed. I mean, you know, he had a stressful job in that he had a lot of pressure on him for a young age. They had moved him up pretty quickly. And so he was, you know, 21 years old, but he's supervising people who are 35 and 40. You know, he's having to fire people. He's having to, you know, discipline people. So, I mean, I think, you know, you work 6 hours on, 6 hours off around the clock for 30 days. You know, my thing with, you know, they've argued, really the only thing they have to support suicide is there's some text messages. Well, you know, you're 21 years old, you're on this boat, you have service some days you don't. You have a girlfriend who's home living in your apartment that you're paying for, and you're paying for everything, and she's driving your car, and you're having people text you telling you, well, you know, she's screwing around with this guy, she's screwing around with that guy, she's doing this. She's even told you, well, here are all the people that I've cheated on you with, you know, in the last few months. And you still stayed with her because she put a guilt trip on you about how everybody always abandons you. Well, he says, okay, well, I'm not going to be that person. I'm going to stick with you, you know. So they got him to come home by Dylan calling him repeatedly and telling him that she was riding around in his car. He had bought a BMW that she was driving, and she was driving around in his car with a drug dealer, as they called it. And, of course, knowing that Christian was going to get mad, and he kept trying to contact her. She wouldn't respond. He knew that she was with Matt Miller, who, you know, they didn't really have a good relationship, Christian and he didn't. And so, I mean, in my opinion, they lured him home. She knew that he was going to find out who she was with. I mean, they had on each other's phone that Find Me or whatever app where they, like, she knew where he was, he knew where she was. I mean, it showed she was at Matt Miller's house. So, you know, he gets mad and he says, I'm getting off the boat, I'm coming home. You know, and tells, you know, everybody, makes arrangement that he'll be back by 5 o'clock that day. So there's no, he intends to come back. I mean, he tells, he leaves his stuff there. He doesn't take anything with him but his cell phone. And then never comes back.
So how, Ray, I just want to ask you, how, as a parent, since all of this has taken place, have you been able to cope personally and as a family? How have you been able to process this, what has happened to your son, and I guess the injustice that you see with this case? How have you been able to deal with all that? I know the anniversary is coming up, and you know, I'm empathetic to that because I know at the core of this, you lost a child. And I think sometimes they get lost into people's minds. They think about the podcast or whether who did it, or, but you still lost a child though. Mm-hmm. And so how have you been able to cope with that?
I mean, I guess I cope like any parent who's lost a child. I think that, again, the podcast and even the investigation, I guess you'd say, helps sometimes because it keeps you busy. And, you know, I had a friend of mine that's a therapist tell me, you know, Ray, you're going to be okay until this is all over with. And then when this is all over with, you're going to fall apart because then you're not going to have, you know, you have a goal right now and you have something you're working toward. And when that's kind of filled all your time and your energy, and when that's taken away from you and this is resolved one way or the other, whatever you want to consider a resolution, you're not going to have anything to kind of fill that void. And, you know, and that may be true, but I don't know. I think that we spoke about this earlier when y'all were setting up, that having all the different media things, whether it was the podcast or whether it's been interviews that we've gone on or something like this, you know, you do get very desensitized to talking about it. And I know you were very, you know, you were being very compassionate and saying, I don't want to upset you by asking this question or asking that question. And I said, ask whatever you want to ask. I've been asked it, you know. And I feel guilty about that sometimes because I feel like I can talk about this, you know, very dispassionately. And it makes me appear cold probably because you do, you know, again, and I say this with tongue in cheek, I don't want anybody to think that I am comparing myself to a rape victim. But just as a rape victim is treated, in many ways, that's how we have been treated and how Christian has been treated. Because, you know, you hear the blame the victim defense when a criminal attorney is defending someone for raping someone. Yeah, you know, you make the victim, you know, well, she was a slut. Well, she brought it on herself. Well, she was this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, she was raped and she was victimized, no matter what her other choices had been. And with Christian, it's like they are blaming, you know, the other side is blaming the victim, and they're trying to demonize him and make it almost like, okay, he was killed. Well, maybe he deserved it, you know. I mean, and they're not saying that, but it's almost like they're trying, you know, they're trying to make it, okay, if it ends up that he was murdered, well, it was a good riddance. I mean, and they've literally said that on the thing, you know, good riddance, you know, that SOB. And it's like, y'all didn't even know him. You never met him, some of these people who are saying these things. And so I think, and then as a family, I think that, you know, having to retell it over and over. And I guess people will say, well, you don't have to do that. You don't have to go do these interviews. And no, we don't. But we do them to keep his story alive and out there and try to keep pressure on the people who can make a difference and make the right decision and help us. You know, unfortunately, that is the only way to get a politician to do something, is to make them think they're going to lose votes and support.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, and Dubo sat there, I'm sure he regretted telling us this, but he sat there, I don't know, 2 years ago? Well, it was before, it was in 2017, it was before Crime Watch. And he said, well, I mean, I can't do anything for you. My suggestion is go get some media attention because Bilbo will hate the media. Well, we went and did that. And, of course, he'd also got him a lot of attention, too. So I'm sure that he wished he'd never said that and never thought that we would get the media attention that we've gotten.
I kind of, it's interesting because I kind of see a dynamic and a similarity in the thing that's going on with your son's case. Same thing like the Trayvon Martin case, in a mm-hmm. sense. It seems like, because at one point they tried to demonize and make him look like he had marijuana in his system. And it still didn't take effect because this adult antagonized him to fight him and then he killed him. And it kind of seems like it's the same way. Like you said, they make the mm-hmm. victim look, demonize the victim.
In the media. This situation, it's not the media, it's social media.
Social media, yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, to make it look like this, to make it look like he was suicidal mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. And in the Trayvon Martin case, they made it look like he was aggressive.
Right.
But this time, the way he died, they're trying to make it sound like he was in that space in his head,
right?
You know, from the outlook, if you didn't believe he did, you know, did
right.
So that's what it kind of looks like to me, and it says in the same vein, and that's why I said it has to come down to actually doing the due diligence and going through the whole process of vetting everything to make sure that this is what this is and this is what this is. Now let's make a consent, mm-hmm. like a judgment on it. You know what I mean? For what it is. When everything is on the table. But what it's like, everything's not on the table, so it's allowing that to continue. Now in your case, like if I really believe he committed suicide and I really thought that, I would be in awe to put everything on the table to let you see it.
Exactly. And again, that's what we've always said. I mean, if you are so sure, prove it to us. Yeah. I mean, or explain these other things away to us. But nobody's been willing to do that. It's always been one excuse after another. You know, again, I keep bringing up Dubo just because he's been typically the only person that would meet with us. Is, you know, well, yeah, I have questions too. Yeah, it doesn't seem right to me either. Well, I mean, he sits there and says, yes, it was a botched investigation. Yes, you know, all these different things. But then you don't do anything. It's like you just say, oh, well, you know, too bad. And I it goes back to what you said earlier. If it was your child, mm-hmm. would you be shrugging your shoulders and saying, oh, well, too bad, you know?
Well, before we go, Ray, I want to ask you one more question. Is there anything that you want people to take away from Christian's life, or anything about you or your family that people may not know, or something that you want to let the public know about your son and the kind of person he was, and just anything about him in general?
Well, I tell, you know, everybody that before the podcast, even after Crime Watch, but before the podcast, you really couldn't have found anybody that would have said a negative thing about Christian. Even the people who are being so ugly about him now, they were totally singing a different tune before the podcast. So, I mean, I guess just that at the heart of things, he was a good guy. He wanted to help people. He'd give you the shirt off his back. Was he perfect? By no means, no. He was your typical 21-year-old, you know. He'd go out and he drank too much sometimes. He cussed too much sometimes. I mean, you know, he said things he shouldn't say sometimes, you know. There's been much ado made about texts on his phone. I think that we all have texted many things that, again, going back to that, how you read the reads you have. I just think that at the end of the day, yes, he was my son, and yes, we all think that our children are good, but he really was a good person. And, you know, there's, I've even called Avery, his girlfriend before Whitley. I remember one time I called her because, you know, they make you doubt yourself, you know, all the noise, it makes you doubt yourself sometimes. And I called her and I said, you know, Avery's mother, who knew him so well, I said, I mean, I know he's my child, but he really was good, a good person, wasn't he? And she says, yes, Ray, don't let them make you doubt that, you know. So I think that at the end of the day, that's all I want people know.
And I really thank you for your time, and our condolences and thoughts go out to you and your family.
Okay, well, thank you all for having me.
Thank you. Please, I'm not here fast.